using free speech to free minds. You're listening to The David Knight Show.
As the clock strikes 13, it's Friday, the 18th of June, year of our Lord, 2021, day 461 of America Held Hostage. Today we're going to have an interview with a family member of someone who is in an American domestic gitmo. We have two of these prisons in America for political prisoners, and you will not believe the kind of treatment they receive. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Yes, earlier this week, as the press was interviewing Putin, leading up to the summit between Putin and Biden, they said they started criticizing him for what he was doing with his political opponent, putting him in prison, leaving him to die, kind of what we're doing to Julian Assange, and also to the Capitol people from January the 6th. And so Putin kind of, what are you talking about? Yeah, they don't blame the mirror for your being ugly. In other words, you're doing the same thing in America. So we're going to talk at the beginning of the next hour to someone about what that looks like for some political prisoners who are not as high a profile, but political prisoners nevertheless. We have a couple of Gitmo-like prisons in America called communication management units. That's where they put the political prisoners, so they're held incommunicado. We'll be talking about that coming up. Before we do, let's take a look quickly at the news. This happened this week. We had Lauren Witzke, who was a candidate, a news figure. She had her bank account canceled, just wiped out without warning. Andrew Torba, chief of Gab, this is a story from WND, their coverage of it, said, today it's Lauren, yesterday it was Gab. Tomorrow it can and will be you. What is her crime? The 33-year-old Lauren Witzke got a terse notice from her bank, Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo, mark that. The available balance on her account read zero. Her entire life savings of about $15,500 have been transferred to loss prevention. This is something they typically do if there is fraud. But they didn't say that she had committed fraud or she was suspected of anything. As a matter of fact, when I was censored, when I was shut down, from PayPal and Venmo, they said, suspicious activity on your account. Then they changed it to, well, you violated the terms of agreement. And then on that message, if I click on, show me the terms of agreement, it just comes back to the same page each time. was this a case of theft or fraud? Had her account been compromised? No. When I called Wells Fargo, said the reporter, they told me that it was a business decision and that they have the right to close my account at any time. That was a report by Michelle Malkin. Wells Fargo said, we do not consider political views or affiliations in making account decisions. Are they telling you the truth? They had a conservative activist and contributor to American Greatness, Pete D'Abroska, I guess is the way he pronounced his name, reported that his Wells Fargo savings account had been shut down the same day as Witzke's. He said, Wells Fargo closed my account without any notice and can't cut me a check for the balance because the checks with the balance is in the mail. They didn't even have the decency to overnight the check. So he's just out of the money until they sent it to him. For her, they did it a little bit differently. The lack of explanation from Wells Fargo as to why they closed down her bank account opens questions as to why the decision was taken to begin with and if it had anything to do with her Christian conservative politics. I said, going back to Andrew Torba of Gab again, he's pointed out he's been banned from 4 banks in the space of 4 weeks earlier this year because of media smears, saying that his site is a haven for extremists and other spurious claims. And that may be what is being involved here. It perhaps is the case that if somebody who doesn't like me or doesn't like her contacts the bank or contacts PayPal, says this person is a dangerous extremist, you just get them purged. That's the world in which we live in now. And we're going to talk about social justice coming up here in a moment. These Marxist tactics. A pro-Trump coffee brand called Covfefe Coffee was banned from using Chase Bank's WePay processor after National File and others reported on the incident. Sales for Covfefe Coffee shot up over 7,500%. As many people believe, as this article says, and I believe this is the case, obvious case of coordinated financial censorship, targeting of citizens by big government and big business, well, banks and the financial strings, based on their political views. Pattern recognition is key. When you look at what the banks have done in the past, remember, it was during the Obama administration they had what they called Operation Choke Point, and they said, we're going to make sure that if you are a gun manufacturer, but especially the gun stores, retail stores, they were just shutting them down left and right. Said, no, we're not going to do business with you because we don't like the fact that you sell guns. If they don't like the information that you're giving, you don't think that they're going to shut you down financially, that they have an Operation Choke Point that's going on there? I think we're going to find that that is exactly the case. I make that prediction. And we'll see what happens with that. By the way, it also extends to the Proud Boys, to Oath Keepers, and others. This Wall Street Journal story the other day, and I have to say, I'm not a... When you look at the story that came out this week from Revolver, they did a great deal of investigation. It's an excellent story, 26 pages when I printed out. I did not go into detail with it because it really wasn't a surprise. I'm glad that they had the information. I'm glad that they did the detailed investigation and showed what had happened in Michigan, the attempt to kidnap Whitmer. I laughed that off the first time I heard it. Are you kidding me? Don't you remember what happened with the Hutterese militia, how they were set up? Don't you remember all of the different cases that we've had from Andrew Napolitano? He did a piece on it once. I played it many times, where he talked about all the different times that the FBI has gone in and organized a plot, quote unquote. They would do everything about it. They would acquire all the materials. They would be the leaders of the plot. They would go out and they'd hustle in some people who were on the margins, people who were about to be homeless in this particular case, the Michigan case. The ringleader had been kicked out by his girlfriend. He was essentially homeless, living in the basement of the hardware shop that he worked at. And they bring in people like that and use them as patsies. And it is no different, and I've said this many times, it's no different than the fireman who starts a fire, commits arson, so that he can show up on the scene and put it out and be a hero. That's what the FBI does over and over again. They've done it so many times. They've done it to Muslims. They're doing it now to conservatives, to Christians, to anti-government people who are fed up with this lockdown. We've seen it over and over again. As a matter of fact, some of the reports looking at what happened in Michigan, reports from people on the left who had seen it so many times being done to Muslims. You know, bringing them in and here's a car. I've loaded it with explosives. Here's the key. Drive it over there. And then, you know, it's like one day it's going to just blow up for these guys. But no, it's they do it over and over again. And so it's not a surprise to me. They did an excellent job of research showing that the same people who had organized that, and they had, I think, 15 people who were indicted, and then that's been dismissed. But they had also 5 undercover agents, and they were the ones who were the ringleaders, really running everything. So that's a pretty big percentage. And the guy who was running that was transferred from Michigan to Washington just before the January the 6th thing. And the initial plot before they started the nonsense about the kidnapping, the thing that the FBI agents were pushing on these guys in Michigan was to storm the Capitol. Sound familiar? So they take the guy in Michigan, the FBI agent who had put together this operation to storm the Capitol, had put in agent provocateurs to entrap some people so they could look like heroes and make Whitmer look good. And then they send him to Washington, and lo and behold, you see the same thing happening there. What did I say the morning of January the 6th? Go back and look at it. That very morning, I've been talking about this type of thing happening. This is why I haven't really covered it this week, because it's not really news. If you listen to me, I said that this whole thing had absolutely no resolution. I said that back in December. It's one of the reasons I was fired from InfoWars, because they wanted to make money off of this. No concern about how this is going to be used to ruin people's lives, to create a false narrative that was going to turn anybody who is a Trump supporter, anybody who pushes back against the narrative of the Biden administration, now you're instantly a domestic terrorist. You see how this has turned out? This is why they did this. And I said the morning of January the 6th, I said this thing is going to be filled with agent provocateurs. Agent provocateurs. I didn't say it was going to be BLM and Antifa, which is what InfoWars and other people were saying. I said it's going to be agent provocateurs. It's going to be people from the government doing this. And you find the bottom line on the revolver piece is that the not only, you know, the guy in charge had just orchestrated a similar thing in Michigan, but you find that the unindicted co-conspirators are, for the most part, the people who are accused of the most violence. That's not typically the way you do things, right? Typically, what you do is you get the people who are not as, did not commit the serious crime, and you will use, but they're associated with it. So you threaten them and get them to come after the people who organized it or who were the most violent. But it's the other way around this time. Isn't that interesting? Now, when I said agent provocateur, I meant agent provocateur. Again, not BLM or Antifa. I said agent provocateur. Here's a definition of agent provocateur. One employed to associate with suspected persons and by pretending sympathy with their aims to incite them to some incriminating action. There are people who had their lives ruined. One particular individual who was a geophysicist, I think it was, a very successful guy, nearly committed suicide, ruined his life. He's going to jail for a very long time because he got caught up in this. He got violent. But yeah, agent provocateur is what I said. So it's not a new thing. But again, going back to what they're talking about with the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and about the political aspects of speech, this article from Wall Street Journal, the interesting part about it was how PayPal cut off Oath Keepers. How, after being shut off by one processor for what it called hate propaganda on a T-shirt, referred to a Democratic politician as a communist and as an idiot, you had Proud Boys, they said, launched a secretive e-commerce site to sell liberal merchandise with slogans such as Black Lives Matter and Impeach 45, referring to Mr. Trump. So what they're saying is that PayPal cut off Oath Keepers. PayPal cut off all of these different organizations, just like they've done to me. And I'm not advocating for the things that they advocated for. And as a matter of fact, I said I'm very suspicious of Terrio himself, Enrico Terrio. I said, I find it extremely suspicious that this guy was whisked out of Washington, D.C. the day before on a really strange way, saying, well, you know, you were here in Washington, D.C., and you burned some merchandise in the street, so you're persona non grata, and we're taking you out of Washington, D.C., and then the next day everything blows up, right? So I'm not defending these people. I don't know which of them are FBI informants. As a matter of fact, Enrico Terrio later came out, had been an FBI informant. But the financial aspect of this that is part of what the Wall Street Journal talks about is, I think, significant. Oath Keepers were stopped. They had a credit card processor called RallyPay used in fundraising. They were shut off. The Proud Boys, after they streamed on DLive, they were banned. And after they did that on DLive, they demonetized political programming completely like mine. So basically what they did, these agent provocateurs, keeps people like me from being able to get any funding there as well. But you understand it's the funding, right? It's the funding being cut off for political purposes. And so they turned to cryptocurrency. By the way, yeah, you can send Bitcoin to me. By the way, we wind up finding that is our only source of funding. They turned to cryptocurrency, to local credit unions, to alternative payment brokers, to encrypted messaging apps such as Telegram, and so forth. So this is what is happening. When we look at that, I tie this together with that story about the political candidate and reporter who just had her account seized. The other reporter on the same day had it closed by Wells Fargo. And this is Operation Choke Point. This is a move to ban people for content from the financial system, all tied together with the government. Just like the social media people are not independent corporations. They are tied together with the government. It's amazing to me that Reason covers for that. But, of course, maybe they don't want to get banned, right? The Fox affiliate, this is also a story that I did not talk about, Ivory Hecker, everywhere. She said Fox was muzzling her to keep certain information from you, the viewer. There were two parts about what I saw, and I kind of waited on this to see if there was anything else coming up. I've not seen anything else other than basically these two things. She said, I've had to pass on Bitcoin stories. Bitcoin for poor African-American audience at 5 is probably not going to play. That's a choice I'm making. It's an editorial choice, said her editor. Well, frankly, that's not censorship. That's just, you look at local news, and what do they focus on? They focus on some special interest stories. They do sports. They do weather. They grab any kind of bleeding violence story from anywhere in the country, and they put it on. As a matter of fact, I remember back when I was in high school, my sister would watch the nightly news every night, the local news every night, because she wanted to see the weather or whatever. But before that, they showed her every single violent story that they could find nationally, as if it was all happening in her neighborhood, is the way she internalized it. That's why when you look at the fear that's been generated by this constant hectoring of the media during the pandemic, I've already seen it before in my sister. She started getting afraid to go out of the house because it's like all these horrible stories about violence, which, again, were magnified because they would cherry-pick these stories from everywhere and report on them as if they were local, part of the local news. And so I understand what they're focused on. It's mainly sports and weather, some local news, and some violence to get people to watch. If you want to talk about finance, you know, there's CNBC, there's other things for that. And so I kind of understand that editorial decision. But then to shut them down on hydroxychloroquine, which is the other thing she said, that is something that the community needs to know. And that is something that indicates a corporate decision to placate their corporate sponsors, the big pharmaceutical companies. Fox has been a big cheerleader of the pharmaceutical companies, and I think it is absolutely criminal, and it should be prosecuted as a crime. What was done to keep us from having hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, these politicians, these media figures who purged it, who mocked it, who threatened, like Whitmer did, threatened pharmacists and doctors with losing their license if they prescribed this, even though we had a lot of doctors who had said this is very, very effective, stopping it very early and making sure the people don't even go to the hospital. You want to make sure you don't have overcrowded hospitals? You don't have to send the cancer patients home. You don't have to lock the door for the heart attack patients. Just allow them to have a cheap over-the-counter medication. But that didn't fit their agenda. Their agenda was they wanted to make obscene profits, and they wanted to have a control mechanism and a justification for surveillance. That's all this was about this whole last year. Fox was complicit in it. Trump was complicit in it. And that is a key thing about this story. They said, you need to cease and desist posting about hydroxychloroquine, citing a New England Journal of Medicine, the people who were key in terms of pushing this. We have Facebook is now going to be able to convincingly alter text and photographs. So what is the purpose of that? Well, they say it's to identify deep fakes. No, no, no. This is about memes. They want to be able to sort down and censor memes. They have, it's a bit of a problem for them. They can't, if they can't identify the text, then they would have to manually do this, and they want to be able to do this algorithmically. They want to be able to censor your memes. That's why they want to be able to identify text and photographs. They want to send the memes down the memory hole. We have a story out of the New York Times that has alarmed a lot of these students who are doing school from home. It is a story of a first-year student at Dartmouth, the School of Medicine. He was on spring break when he got a notice from the school, said, we think you were cheating online. And they said, we think that because while you were taking the remote exam, they allow them to take the exams at home on Zoom or whatever. We noticed that while you were taking the exam, you Googled some stuff, indicated that you'd looked up some test material, which means that they were spying on him, which is the aspect of this that a lot of people have said. I looked at it and I thought, well, I'm kind of surprised because I didn't even think that tests, grades, and merit even mattered anymore in these medical schools. This guy is a Siri Zhang, a first-year student. I don't know. Again, they have said in California, we're not even going to take a look at your SATs. This is not about equal opportunity. This is about equal results, equity, and we're going to talk about that later. But that really is where the universities live. So in one sense, yeah, it's kind of creepy that they're spying on him, but they are doing the Zoom school. Expect that if you're doing something on the computer, it's being spied on. And I was somewhat reassured that there's still a little bit of merit involved in the medical school there. I just, when you look at what is happening to our society, this idiocracy that we're going into, it's because they don't really care about merit anymore. They don't care about competition with any of this stuff. We had a statement from Joe Biden when he was in Switzerland to meet Vladimir Putin, both of them, you know, wringing their hands about Americans having firearms while they're surrounded by an army of people with firearms and with an anti-aircraft gun. And Biden said this. He said, you heard me say this before again and again, and I'm going to keep saying it. What's that idea? We don't derive our rights from government. We possess them because we're born, period. And then we yield them to government. Not in my case, pal. I'm not giving you anything. Nothing at all. And by the way, I thought it was kind of interesting because he left God out of that equation. He left the Creator out of that equation, unlike our founders. They argued the case for natural rights as being the fact that we are all created by God, and not simply because we're born. And isn't it interesting that he said, you possess them because you're born, because that would not only leave out God from the equation of human rights and being created in the image of God, the dignity and the uniqueness of man compared to other animals, but it would also leave out any rights for the unborn. Oh, yeah, very clever. Maybe, you know, he's not so stupid after all, just senile. He has been. Juneteenth, a new federal holiday. 44 paid days off each year now for the federal employees who in the 78 largest federal agencies. Think about that. We don't just have 78 federal agencies. These are the 78 largest federal agencies. I guess it's a number like the deficit that is too big to count. But in the 78 largest federal agencies, the average salary is $100,000 or more. So conservatives, in other words, this is Forbes, are looking at this and saying, this is outrageous. Yeah, this is just too much money. I have a different take on this. Again, they've got 44 paid days off each year, nearly 9 weeks of paid time off. You know, when they get to 45, the next holiday they add. Maybe they'll have a holiday for, I don't know, Saul Alinsky or something. But when they get to 45 days, that'll be a full 9 weeks. So they're only one day shy of 9 weeks of paid vacations. And the tact on this by the financial papers is, look at how much this is costing us every year. We think on average this is costing us $22.6 billion annually. Here's my take on this. I'd be more than willing to give them 365 days a year off with pay if they leave us alone. Just leave me alone. Here, take the money and go away. Universal basic income for federal bureaucrats. We could call it universal bureaucrat income. How about that? You don't even need to change the acronym, UBI. And we'll pay you even more if you leave us alone. Because you think it's expensive to give these people a day off? That's $22.6 billion annually. Think about the trillions of dollars they cost us when they're there. We can't afford them showing up. Governor Abbott, speaking of money, has now put a $250 million down payment, as he puts it, on a Texas border wall. And this, quite frankly, is just virtue signaling to the base. So do it anyway, but it's not even that much money compared to what Abbott did a year ago. A year ago, Abbott gave $295 million. This is $250 million for the border, and everybody is talking about it. Oh, look at this. He's going to take proactive action with the border. And then you have DeSantis saying, and I'll send some Florida police to help you patrol it and all this sort of thing. Okay, so that's being picked up. There's a lot of political posturing going on with these people. A year ago, nobody reported about this except for local papers in Texas. For example, this is texasstandard.org. But I saw it. And I reported it. The fact that he put nearly $300 million into a shell corporation, to do contact tracing at the very beginning of this pandemic, early on. It was early May that he did that. And it was, there were people on both, bipartisan opposition, and the press were looking at this, but just the state press, just the local press, the Houston Chronicle and some others looked into it. As I pointed out, he got bipartisan criticism for hastily awarding nearly $300 million to a little-known North Texas company. They're up in Frisco, Texas, a suburb of Dallas, and all they had was an empty office. And the guy who was the CEO had a bogus resume. Nothing to see here, right? And I said from the beginning, I said, you watch out. Abbott is on the wrong side with this lockdown. He's going to do some bad, and he did. He put us under a mask mandate a couple months after that. Little evidence that the company, MTX Group, has the qualifications to manage contact tracing in Texas. What we really have here is a giant corporation, giant government contract awarded to a little-known company for something that's very important and needs to be done right, said one individual. So that's the criticism. That's why they got the bipartisan criticism. But I looked at it and said, contact tracing? At the very beginning of this? This is well before, it's a couple of months before he put in his mask mandate and other things. Democrats and Republicans criticized Abbott for the decision. Several prominent companies had also bid for the contract, and each had only 2 days to complete a proposal. The contract, $300 million, was awarded 6 days later. Two Austin-based lobbyists each began $50,000 lobbying arrangements with MTX Group the day the state approved its bid. So a lot of questions are being raised about the process, about the lack of transparency. And it took this organization, the Texas Standard, so it took us a week to get the contract, and when we did, it was heavily redacted. You're not allowed to see what they're going to do for contact tracing. Why is that? I mean, this is supposed to be open and above board. It's about just our health, right? This isn't anything sinister. Why do you have to redact that? Heavily redacted. You know, when I look at some of the stuff that Abbott has done on the Second Amendment, good stuff, but he's now running very hard to the right. We'll get some good things done because of that. He has political aspirations beyond the office of governor, and he's trying to recoup his reputation after he sold us out, like Trump did, to the globalists. So now, one day after he signed the bill from that was passed by the Republican Senate to do constitutional carry, now he signed a bill exempting any Texas-made suppressors from federal regulation. In Hollywood vernacular, that is a silencer. And so this is something that has been proposed in many other states to say if firearms are made in a particular state and they are sold to people living in the state, they are kept in the state, they don't cross state lines, the federal government should have no involvement in it. And that's absolutely correct. And so that's the principle that the Texas legislature and this bill that was signed by Abbott is all about. Quote, a firearm suppressor that is manufactured in this state and remains in this state is not subject to federal law or to federal regulation, including registration under the authority of the U.S. Congress to regulate interstate commerce, because it isn't interstate commerce. So the question I have, does that mean that I can go out and get a threaded oil filter now? Save my hearing? Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. It's going to be a big run now on oil filters in the state of Texas. I'm manufacturing here. I really am. Second Amendment Sanctuary Act was also signed. It bars the in-state enforcement of certain gun control laws. And as the and by the way, the constitutional carry thing, Texas, that made Texas the 21st state to have that. So we've got 42% of the states have constitutional carry in the U.S. That means that you don't have to have the privilege of getting a license and jumping through hoops to carry a pistol, openly or concealed. The other states are Alaska, Arizona. I'm putting this out as a public service announcement in case you want to get out of California and need to know where you can go. These are your top 21 states. Texas, and then Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Maine, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, Utah, Vermont, West Virginia, and Wyoming. Those are your, that's your short list when you get out of California. The DOJ, meanwhile, was not happy about this because in Missouri, they did the same type of thing. Everybody is expecting the federal government under Biden to do a lot of gun control. We've already had the executive order to say we're going to come after people for the braces. This is really more about establishing and extending the precedent that Trump established with the bump stocks, that we can do executive order. I tell the BATF with an executive order, I want you to regulate this. The BATF writes the details of it, and they just prohibit that way. Skip the legislature completely. Skip the Constitution, too, by the way. And so the acting assistant attorney general, Brian Boynton, sent a letter to Missouri when they did the same thing that Texas just did yesterday. The Justice Department is warning Missouri officials that the state can't ignore federal law after the governor signed a bill last week that bans police from enforcing federal gun rules. They said the new rule will penalize local police departments if their officers enforce federal gun law. So the state is going to withhold funding from the police departments if they cooperate with the federal government to enforce these new gun control laws that are coming from the Biden administration. It's the same thing that we always see, the money, the carrot and the stick. And that's why I say it's been 461 days, because it was the money, the carrot and the stick that was used by the federal government with Trump's executive order to get the lockdown. The same thing that the governor is using in Missouri to say that we are not going to give your local police department we're going to cut your funding if you go through with this. And we have, and as we see in this article, this is a good angle that was picked up by Chris Minahan, informationliberation.com. The DOJ is warning the conservative states, I'm not going to use the colors, I hate using these colors, red and blue, come on. Red is socialism, Marxism. They're warning the conservative states that you can't void federal gun laws while they're giving money to the liberal states to void federal immigration laws. See, Trump understood, again, he's not stupid. When he used financial incentives to get the lockdown, he'd already done that with immigration. When you had Democrat cities and states saying, we're going to be sanctuary cities, Trump said, all right, we're going to cut funding to you. Right? And so now what they're saying is the Biden administration is threatening to cut money to states if they support the Second Amendment. And then they are now restoring the funding to these states who have created sanctuary cities for illegal aliens. You understand how that works? It's called money. It's called the Federal Reserve. That's how the Federal Reserve is the key thing behind this. Well, Boynton said, the acting assistant attorney general said, the bill conflicts with federal firearms laws and regulations, and a federal law would supersede any of the state's new statutes. Well, no, actually, not true. And this is why we need to go back, and nobody is making this argument. We need to go back and look at medical marijuana. Two-thirds of the states. This is marijuana is still a Schedule I drug, which says that it has absolutely no medical use, and yet we have two-thirds of the states said it's legal to have it for medical use. And even Sessions, as much as he hated marijuana, did not come after that. because they don't have the authority. You have the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. Then you have nullification. And you also have anti-commandeering, which says that the federal government cannot commandeer local or state law enforcement to enforce their laws. And that has been upheld going back to the 1800s in five separate Supreme Court cases. We're 5-0 on anti-commandeering. We'll talk about the Supreme Court when we come back. But they don't have a leg to stand on, frankly. And in Utah, you have all 29 of the Utah sheriffs have promised to protect the Second Amendment. And you know why that is happening. It's because when the Mormons went to Utah, they were being attacked, and they actually had the U.S. government send in the military to attack them. They were able to defend themselves, mainly because they had a guy who was a Mormon. Browning was his name. You may have seen some of his firearms works. He was a firearms genius. And they fought them off. And so all 29 of these sheriffs, I understand, they remember that history. All 29 of the sheriffs have said, as your elected sheriffs, we individually and collectively pledge to do everything within our power to steadfastly protect the Second Amendment and all other individual rights guaranteed by the Constitution. And so they know it's coming. We know it's coming. One last thing here. The city of San Jose has now mandated videotaping of all gun purchases. This is why I said, you know, for all you people in California, I just gave you as a public service the list of the 21 states that you may want to keep in mind that you want to go to be able to defend yourself, and many other reasons as well. So San Jose is going to require retailers to video record all firearm purchases. They will be the largest city in California with such a rule. They did it less than a month after a disgruntled employee fatally shot 9 of his co-workers and then himself in a rail yard in San Jose. But, of course, there's absolutely nothing that indicates. They're saying that the reason that you want to do this is because they want to stop straw man purchasing, where somebody goes in and buys a firearm for someone who is not allowed to buy a firearm and then gives it to them. That's not what was involved in this case, to my knowledge, at all. Instead, this is really about intimidation, intimidating people from buying firearms. The mayor's plan also calls for a separate ordinance that would require gun owners to carry liability insurance, okay, and to pay a fee to cover taxpayer costs associated with firearm violence. So you're already guilty just by having a firearm. You know, you're contributing to death everywhere. No, actually, firearms keep that from happening. I'm not going to go into the story, but I've mentioned it before, how my grandfather, whose brother-in-law had just been killed on a route where they were collecting money, he was the one who found the body. Police couldn't find him. He was stuffed in the trunk, killed with an axe. My grandfather always carried a pistol. He'd been a streetcar conductor and some other things before he got started his own business. He eventually saved up money and started his own business. But he always carried a pistol with him. And so he got a little bit more cautious about it, and he came back to his vehicle. This is back in the 1920s. And there was a guy hiding in the back of the vehicle. Wasn't that hard to get into cars back then? Probably isn't that hard today if you know what you're doing. Anyway, he was hiding in the back to attack him once he got in the car. He pulled the gun on him and said, if I ever see you again, I'm going to shoot you first. There was no report filed. There was nothing in the paper saying, man's life saved by firearm. But that's truly the case. I'm here today because of that. It's outrageous that Mayor Liccardo of San Jose wants to use Big Brother-style omnivalence, total surveillance, in other words, to record gun owners' every move, violating the privacy of millions, especially at-risk firearm purchasers, said a coalition's statement. Yeah, omnivalence. I've never seen that before. But I've said that if you take the three characteristics of God, omnipotence, omnipresence, and omniscience. Those are the those are the goals of the surveillance state. Because they want to be God, they think they are God. We'll be right back.
Light up, Palucky, it's light up time. Be happy, go lucky, it's light up time.
For the taste that you like, light up, Palucky Strike.
Relax. It's light up time.
Our friend Happy Joe Lucky has the right idea. Relax and light up a better tasting Lucky Strike. You'll find that Luckies do taste better, and for good reasons. First, LSMFT. Lucky Strike means fine tobacco.
I got my COVID-19 vaccination, and here's why. This isn't about gimmicks or sentiment or what commercial I like. This is about facts. COVID-19 vaccines are safe and effective. Millions of doses have already been given in the United States, and these vaccines have the most intensive safety monitoring in U.S. history. When you need more information, use a reliable source like the CDC website and get the facts.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via or donate via Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our... Day 461. And this headline from Roll Call. Senators are running out of patience. I think they've been very patient, don't you? They have held their peace. They have allowed all this stuff to go on for 461 days. I mean, you look at the Republicans. Nobody criticized Fauci while Trump was in office. They even gave a little bit of breathing room there so it wouldn't look too awkward. And then they got serious about criticizing Fauci. They're still not criticizing the techniques of this. They're not criticizing the bioweapon experiments, the gain-of-function experiments. They're not criticizing the tactics that have been used for this. No, it's strictly partisan. But even the Democrats are running out of patience now. They're saying, hey, we've been wearing these masks for a long time. We've been vaccinated multiple times. Can't you just take the masks off now? For travelers. And so you have Rick Scott of Florida, and you have Brian Schatz of Hawaii. Because, hey, to get to Hawaii, oh, that's right, you put on a mask. Oh, and then you get in a plane for a long time, right? They don't like that. So you have a Democrat from Hawaii and Rick Scott saying, we're impatient, and we want to, they've introduced a, quote, sense of the Senate resolution that would encourage the Biden administration to reconsider its rule, acknowledging that while the agencies are experts on the issues, they are not infallible. Sometimes they move slowly, said Democrat Schatz. Sometimes they're a little too precautionary. We love them. We want them to be able to rule us. We would never question their authority, just like they won't question the authority of any other bureaucrats or of the bureaucrats who wear black robes at Supreme Court. No. I'm not going to rock the boat here and say, who are you to tell me what to do? Since when do we suspend the Constitution because you say that there's a pandemic that I can't see any evidence of? No. They're not going to say that. We say, well, you know, you're moving a little bit too slowly. You're a little bit too precautionary. I think you need to move this up a little bit, please. Can I please have my life back? They even asked Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, or Booty Marks, about travelers on airplanes who were required to wear masks while those gathered in crowded airports and bars were not. What's the deal? Yes, same thing you see at a restaurant. Sorry, you have to wear your mask to walk 5 feet to get the table, but then you can leave it off as long as you want, 2 hours if you want. See, nobody sitting down here has got a mask on their face, but you'll have to wear it in order to get a table here. A number of people from different places passing through the same small place, they said. That's why we have to have it. And it's because of children on the airplane, because we don't have the vaccines in them yet. Well, if your vaccines work, you don't have to worry about it, right? I mean, that's what Trevor Noah was saying. He was saying, so does this work or not? I was told to get this. Does it not work? Is that why I still have to wear a mask and do social distancing and all this stuff? Oh, yeah. No, you got to wear it until we can get it into the kids. That's the line coming from Leanna Wen, the former CEO of Planned Parenthood, who wants to get the kids that she wasn't able to kill in the womb. We can't let these people out. You can't take the mask off of them until we get everybody vaccinated, especially those dirty little rugrats that I wasn't able to kill before they were born. That's what she's coming for. A group of parents, I talked about this on the radio show yesterday, but I didn't get it on here on the podcast. A group of parents sent their kids' face masks to a lab for analysis. Guess what they found? And the dirty Faucis. What do you think you'd find if you took, if you required people to wear a diaper for 8 hours a day? They could never take it off. They couldn't change it even after they soiled it. And so then you send it to a lab. What do you think you're going to find? Well, that's exactly what they found. Not fecal matter, not urine, but instead they found all of the different viruses that these young people who have an immune system that kills the virus, disassembles the virus, and will also neutralize bacteria if it's working properly. What they found was 11 alarmingly dangerous pathogens in the mask, but they were in such small quantities that you'd need to have a PCR test magnified to a cycle threshold of 40 to tell people that they're sick with it, right? Because they weren't sick. So you have, there's a couple of things to learn from this. Of course, Town Hall does not take it to where I'm taking it with a PCR, but they should. They should say, our bodies are infected all the time with all types of things. I had pneumonia, tuberculosis, meningitis, sepsis, keratitis, encephalitis, bloodstream infections, food poisoning, E. coli, Lyme disease, diphtheria, Legionnaire's disease, meningitis, and you know, they have a couple of different forms of meningitis, sepsis. They found viral debris from all this stuff. Why? Because you have all kinds of viral debris in your body all the time. But if you take a PCR test and you look for one particular type of viral debris and you magnify it with a cycle threshold of 40, which is 2 to the 40th power, that's a trillion. By the way, I had somebody write me a letter and said, did he mean 10 to the 40th power? It's like, no, it's 2 to the 40th power. They double it, and then they double it again, and then they double it again, and they double it. 40 times they do that, and that gets you a 1 trillion magnification. Half of the masks were contaminated with one or more strains of pneumonia-causing bacteria. One-third were contaminated with one or more strains of meningitis-causing bacteria. One-third were contaminated with dangerous antibiotic-resistant bacteria pathogens. In addition, less dangerous pathogens were identified, including pathogens that can cause fever, ulcers, acne. And we can see that on their face. It's clear as the pimple on their face. Yeast infections, strep throat, periodontal disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and more. The face mask studies were new or freshly laundered before wearing, and the Faucis had only been worn for 5 to 8 hours, most of them during in-person schooling by children age 6 through 11. One Fauci was worn by an adult. As a control, they looked at a T-shirt that was worn by one of the children all day at school and at some unworn masks that were tested as controls. In other words, they washed them all together. And they took some of the ones that have been washed, and they didn't put them on the kids' faces all day. And again, you are constantly expelling waste when you breathe. That's why we call it a face diaper. Masks provide a warm, moist environment for bacteria to grow. The Fauci is a Petri dish, or we should say a Petri diaper. So should we be more concerned about somebody breathing or somebody having a filthy Fauci on their face? They have an Iowa man who pulled down his COVID-19 mask in an argument, and then he spat on a man's face. They have now sentenced him to 10 years in prison. This is clearly the guy lost his temper, and clearly he spat on the guy. But this should be something like a misdemeanor. This should not be a 10-year sentence. This is not a death sentence to have somebody spit on you. He wasn't even sick. This is a dispute over the mask. If they really wanted to lock him up, if he really wanted to get the guy sick, he should have taken his Fauci all the way off It was just below his nose. He should have taken it all the way off and rubbed it on the other guy's face. Then they could have sent him to jail for 10 years, right? He says, if I have it, you have it. When they got into the argument. He rejected a plea deal, which would have meant 2 years of probation. And he went for a jury trial. And the jury that has been turned obsessive compulsive disorder by a year of porn, pandemic porn, by Fox and by CNN, the jury found him guilty of a higher offense and gave him 10 years. 10 years. Unbelievable. Unfortunately, this is in Iowa. It's not in Florida because DeSantis has pardoned violators of mask mandates and social distancing rules. He announced that all Floridians who are arrested or fined for violating mask mandates or social distancing requirements will be pardoned. And this went before the Pardon Board, the Board of Executive Clemency. They review the pardons from the governor. And that board voted 3-1 to do it. I looked at that and thought, 3-1? Who is the one? Well, the one is a Democrat who wants to run against DeSantis next year. I think she just ended her chances. In Florida. Can you believe that she thinks that she's going to win the election in Florida by trying to punish people who violated these ridiculous, useless social distancing rules and masks? Her name is, by the way, Nikki Fried. And I think she needs to have the label put on her by the Republican Party if she runs. They could call her Florida's Deep Fried Whitmer. Nikki is the Deep Fried Whitmer. With moratorium ending, more than 8 million households facing foreclosure or eviction. And this is a moratorium that was put on by the CDC, extended by the CDC, put on by the CDC under the Trump administration, extended under the Trump administration. It's now been extended by the Biden administration. They may be pulling this off. And at that point, people who have who are behind in their rent or in their mortgage could be evicted. But I've said before that this is not the kind of, in this particular article from CBS, they focus on individuals who are behind in their mortgage payments and how they will likely get kicked out. I don't think there'll probably be something that will help people who are homeowners living in it. But I don't think there'll be any help for the investors and the people who, like those Chinese immigrants who escaped communism, went to New York. It was a Reason report. And you know, you have people who wanted to improve their life, came to America to be free. They worked menial tasks. They were cleaning hotel rooms. They were cleaning as janitors because they didn't have the English language skills. They could even be a waitress or a waiter. And yet they saved a little bit of money for a down payment. They got a mortgage on it. They started renting it because they realized that if they could get in with the real estate, they could start to own something and build their wealth gradually. Well, those poor people, many of them, they had people who were taking advantage of that. And who's going to help them with a bank? Nobody's going to have sympathy for the small, poor, middle-class landlord. And so some of them were $80,000 behind. And they were going to lose all of their wealth, all of their investment in that. So that's what you're going to wind up seeing, I think. Rebel News points out that in Canada, at least in the town of Hamilton, when the reporters show up to cover people who are protesting these lockdowns, they said the poobahs in Hamilton don't care for non-mainstream media types practicing journalism there. So they come out with the ticket books. He said, the other day, via email, I received a whopping $560 ticket from Hamilton bylaw enforcement officer. And he said, so what do I do about this? He said that it's an administrative monetary penalty system ticket. No judge, no jury, no court. Instead, you have to make a plea to the very same people who issued the ticket in the first place. And this is key. This is what they have been working at for a very long time, to make sure that they have removed any legal system, any due process. Well, I'll give you another reason why the Democrats need to be coming back, not just the filthy Faucis on their faces, but all this Zoom stuff has proved to be very embarrassing for some of them. For example, just look at this Marvel superhero. He is a Democrat. He's a Democrat from New Jersey. I'm from New Jersey. You from Jersey? I'm from Jersey, too. Here he is in a Zoom meeting and you see all of the different people at the Zoom meeting, and he decides he's going to get up. And basically, you have Tubman enter the chat room. Here we go.
Rising capability CISA has built through a pilot called Cyber Sentry, which allows CISA to partner with certain strategically placed critical infrastructure to monitor and detect.
Yeah, you may want to come back and just work, right? As one Republican, Brian Mast from Florida, said, if taxpayers are paying you $174,000 a year, getting out of bed and putting on some clothes for work seems like it should be a minimum requirement. We ought to return to in-person hearings immediately. There was another one, which I won't play for you, where there was a woman who was talking a long time, and she had an elderly woman, a congresswoman, and she had a Democrat, and she had real, real heavy false eyelashes on. And as she's looking down and reading this, that's all you see is the big, heavy false eyelashes, and you hear a comment from somebody in the background, and then it flips over to who, and you see who it is that's commenting. And she said, those eyelashes. And then a little bit more time, and you hear her say, caterpillars. At that point, the people who are back live in the congressional floor say, somebody has got to mute their Zoom. They're on the microphone. She didn't know she was making those cases as she was throwing shade on Zoom at this woman. I don't know who she thought she was talking to. When we look at what is happening, for example, in Belgium, and this is an important story for all of us as we were talking a little bit about the January 6th thing, about agent provocateurs and other issues. Why fed-up Belgians are backing a heavily armed Flemish Rambo fugitive as a symbol of anti-establishment frustration. It's a story from RT. As a manhunt for a heavily armed Flemish Rambo continues into its second month, with police seemingly no closer to finding the elusive former corporal, the saga has exposed Belgium's deeply flawed political system that has left millions, just like the fugitive, feeling disaffected, ignored, and facing no democracy. Career soldier Jurgen Konings, 46, remains at large and alive. The authorities fear that he might come through with the threats that he made and a note that he left behind against a Belgian virologist who remains in hiding with his family. So he's upset with this virologist. He's also upset with the unelected bureaucrats who locked everybody down. The only offense that he's committed so far since disappearing is removal of weapons from an army stockpile. They were coming after him. He found that they were coming after him to arrest him because of what he had said, criticizing his people. Maybe they were threats, but he had criticized them. Again, was it a threat, serious threat, or was it part of his rhetoric? And so they were going to arrest him, and he grabbed a bunch of weapons from the base and disappeared. So then they took it as a legitimate threat. So he has since, after he did that, he became a lightning rod, as they point out in RT, for the left behinds of Belgium, not just for his right-wing allegiance, but for his anti-establishment views that are commonplace in certain geographical areas of Belgium, especially with the Flemish people. On a Facebook page, they put up saying, as one behind Jurgen, is how it translated, in other words, people who supported him, they immediately got 50,000 followers before Facebook took it down. And one of the individuals there, Belgium Euro MP, remarked, he said, these people are not supporting a terrorist. Konings has grown into something more. He's become a symbol of someone standing up against the government. However, I have the impression that he just flipped at a certain moment. He thought he needed to do something. Eventually, he did it, and now he's disappeared, and it's a tragedy. I said, what drove him to this point, however, is no mystery to the Belgium member of the European Parliament. We have had a lockdown of some degree now for 18 months, and people are dissatisfied with virologists like this one that he mentioned. Nobody voted for him, and nobody voted for the federal minister of health. So we're being governed by people we did not vote for, and this is something which added to the atmosphere of public sympathy for this guy, which is why I say this is happening worldwide. It doesn't matter which political party you're in. You know, Boris Johnson is supposed to be a conservative. No, he's a green. All these people are green globalists because now they're talking about doing a climate lockdown. For the same reason. It's always about the same global agenda. All of these people, it doesn't matter if they're Republicans or Democrats, if they are conservative or liberal, Doesn't matter which country they're in. Australia, Canada, the U.S., Belgium, it doesn't matter. They're all following that globalist agenda. Now, what do we do about this? And I say that this is the dangerous part right now. Because if this guy has flipped, and now it's been several weeks and he hasn't done anything. So hopefully he's just holed up somewhere and he's not going to do anything unless they come after him. But even if he does this stuff defensively, he's playing their game. And this is why I say we have to engage in asymmetric warfare. Asymmetric warfare doesn't mean that we shoot at him from behind the bushes instead of lining up and taking him direct. It means that we don't shoot at them. Think about this. As they say, if the polls are right, these two parties that are against this lockdown, that do not want to be ruled by unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats, they could have a majority in the Flemish Parliament. What do you think will happen if this guy attacks somebody, assassinates somebody, or even if they come after him and he kills a bunch of people who are trying to arrest him? That is going to play into their hands, just as January 6th did. And so we have to be wise about this. We have to fight them in true asymmetric warfare. And that means that we fight the tactics of Christ. You can see it in what Gandhi did. Essentially, we live our lives, make them take the hits at us. We are the anvil. They can be the hammer. They can hammer us until they break their handle on their hammer. We'll take the blows. We're going to transcend these people. Do not fight. Do not initiate this. If you do, you can see how they use this with the January the 6th event, how they have always used it. That's why I said from the very beginning, there are going to be agent provocateurs that are going to use this for the government to increase its power. It's going to backfire against us. And anybody who supports this, whether it's the president or Alex Jones or anybody else, is playing into that game. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about what they do with political dissonance right now. Stay with us. We've got an interview coming up with Dana Gottesfeld. We'll be right back. The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. thedavidknightshow.com. All right, Dana is going to be joining us shortly to talk about how we treat our dissidents here in America and to give us an update about the particulars of her husband's situation. It's always important that we understand how any of us can be swept up into this. And if we don't stand for due process, if we don't stand for humane treatment, if we don't stand for transparency, this is what awaits each and every one of us eventually. While we're waiting for her, let's talk a little bit about what the National Review said about Stephen Colbert. I thought this was a spot-on article. The breaking of Stephen Colbert. Well, you could say it was the making of him, right? I mean, he's a made man by the system because he's a sellout. He's an unfunny, transparent, corporate shill. And even more so than the painful to watch clawing of trying to get control as you had Jon Stewart using satire to destroy this absurd narrative that they put out. Stephen Colbert trying to to interrupt him trying to claw that back. Even more disturbing than that was that commercial that I also showed a couple of days ago where he had the dancing hypodermic needles and the little jingle with, you know, Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson. What a corporate shill. It was ridiculous. But as I pointed out, Colbert forced himself to do night after dreary night a feeble Robert Mueller joke since broken his spirit. Well, he wasn't forced to do that. He was pandering to his corporate masters, his political masters, and a segment. And to his shame, he has destroyed comedy for a lot of people because he's turned it into a kind of Marxist commentary where something that's really funny is not allowed. You're not allowed to poke fun of the other side. As a matter, you go back and you look at what Jay Leno used to do back in the day, not that he'd be any better today. But when we didn't have a Marxist approach to comedy, Jay Leno would criticize both sides, and it was funny. And I can laugh at people that I agree with, you know, and see it for what it is. I mean, I used to always see Saturday Night Live. You knew that they were hardcore Democrats, and their criticism of Republicans in many cases was over the top, ridiculous, and I knew where they were going. But I could still laugh at the joke behind it. But these people don't allow you to laugh at their candidates. That's the key. When you look at Spitting Image, and I showed that the other day, I said, look at how they have a spot-on characterization of Boris Johnson. But you know when they have Xi Jinping from China? They don't do anything about him that is a parody. He is treated with reverence. I'm serious. This is Spitting Image. They have ridiculed everybody on both sides of the political aisle in the UK. They ridicule American politicians, French politicians. They ridicule the royal family. But when it comes to President Xi, oh no, they don't do anything to his face. And they don't have him do anything stupid. It's like, wow, that is pretty amazing, frankly. So as National Review pointed out, the live audience obviously liked Stewart's material and gives at most a tepid reaction to Colbert's repeated attempts to rebut Stewart and to throw off Stewart's comic timing. And above all, Colbert spends the entire segment desperately disassociating himself from Stewart. At one point, he cracks that Stewart must be working for Republican Senator Ron Johnson. The message was simple. It doesn't matter if the stuff you're saying is funny. It doesn't matter if the stuff you're saying is true. What matters is that you're putting me and my show on the wrong side, and that's a problem. It's kind of like somebody that I used to work for, frankly. Why is the official narrative about the origin of COVID suddenly changing? It's a story from Janet Phelan. And I think that's an important thing. When we look at that, why didn't CBS pull off Jon Stewart? They would have just a couple of months ago. As a matter of fact, there was one news organization, I forget who it was, they said, we're going to show you a video here that would have gotten us banned off of YouTube. And they showed the exchange back and forth between Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. It would have gotten anybody banned. And yet it didn't. And so we should ask, why is the official narrative changing? Because you've got Vanity Fair doing an in-depth expose of that. You have the Wall Street Journal talking about it now. Now it's obvious to everybody. When it was getting us banned a year ago, to say something like that. But as Janet Phelan talks about this, she says you would automatically get censored. You had Zero Hedge that was kicked off simply because they pointed out, oh, look at the LinkedIn profile of this guy. He says he's doing exactly what, you know, combining coronavirus with a bat. So when one narrative appears to be failing, very often they'll use another one to take its place, says Janet. She said a lot of people are not vaccinated, so part of this is that they want to scare people into doing this. And that was my problem about talking too much about what I believed was the case. I said it was the case, but I said, let's not focus on that aspect because, first of all, no matter how bad this thing is, no matter whether or not it was deliberately released, and that's what she's talking about. She says, notice how everybody's staying away from talking about gain-of-function research and the possibility that it was deliberately released. It's always about now the lab leak, the lab leak, the lab leak. It could have leaked, could have been deliberately, but they won't talk about the deliberate aspect of it. And they won't talk about how it was deliberately used to stoke fear, how I think it's being used to stoke fear now as another phase to combat vaccine hesitancy. Yes, VH. I'm VH positive and proud of it. So joining us now, I think we do have her on the line. Is that correct? Dana Gottesfeld, thank you for joining us, Dana.
Hi, David. So good to see you again.
Thank you for coming on. And we have an update into Marty's situation, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to get Dana on. But I also wanted to talk about what is happening at the Communications Management Unit where your husband is there. Let's do real quickly a background. I'll try to summarize this, and then I'll let you tell everybody what I missed and didn't get quite right. But basically, Marty is in jail because of a medical kidnapping situation that arose at a hospital that's affiliated with Harvard, the Boston Children's Hospital. This is not the first time this hospital has been accused of medical kidnapping. And this was a case of Justine Peltier, who had been treated by another doctor at a very prestigious university, medically treated for a particular condition. She went to she had some minor thing, and it was over the weekend, so she went to the Boston Children's Hospital. Somebody who had just done their doctorate paper, research paper on psychosomatic illnesses, diagnosed her with exactly what they'd just done their research paper on. It was not a psychosomatic illness, but they treated it as such, and they kidnapped her medically. They said, no, you can't take her out. We are going to deny her the medication. She was wasting away. And it became something of a cause. The accusation of what they found Marty to be guilty of was hacking into the hospital system on the administrative side. Nobody was affected that had any medical issues, nothing like that. As a matter of fact, it's kind of like what you've seen with the ransomware attacks, where they came into the financial systems, except there was no money involved. It was not a ransomware attack. It was just a hack to publicize this and to embarrass them. And it was done at a time when they were having a fundraiser. And because Harvard is so politically connected, they came after Marty. Again, there was no money involved. There was no threat to any patients. And he got a stiff jail sentence. Now, what did I miss there, Dana?
Great summary. I think what he's accused of is a DDoS, a distributed denial of service. Mm-hmm. And that's like too many people showing up at a restaurant so that the regular customers can't get in.
That's right. Yeah, so it wasn't actually a hack into the system. It was a DDoS where it was denial of service during a fundraiser is essentially it.
Yeah,
that was the charge.
Recognized, as a form of protest as opposed to, I wouldn't consider it any like near ransomware. That we had a trial and the jury said no patients were even potentially put at harm. Justina's case was quite scary. Her parents were going to the media saying, we're afraid our daughter is going to die. Anybody, mm-hmm. please help us. And after a year of fighting, within a month of this happening, she was moved to a better facility and then reunited with her parents. So we're happy that she's back with them.
Well, let me ask you, what kind of a sentence? That they found him guilty of this, and he's appealing different aspects of this, and we'll talk about the appeal because there's been an update to that this week. But how long did they sentence him for crime of DDS that they found him guilty of?
Yeah, Judge Nathaniel Gorton gave him a 10-year sentence.
Wow.
Plus restitution and probation afterwards.
And again, when you look at this, I don't think that he should have been sentenced. If he did it, I don't think that he should have been sentenced at all because he was defending the life of Justine Peltier if he did it. And but this is excessive punishment, certainly, 10-year sentence, because we see this type of cyber crime that's happening all the time. There was, again, no financial cost to them except an embarrassment during a fundraiser. No harm was done to anybody in any of that. So to get a 10-year sentence for that was absolutely over the top. But then they did something else. They put him in a communications management unit, which I think most Americans don't realize what that is. We have kind of our – people talk about Gitmo, and they talk about how difficult that is. But they also set up a communications management unit, which is kind of a domestic Gitmo. There's one in Indiana where Marty is and where Schaefer Cox is. But there's actually, I think, two of them in the U.S. where they hold political dissidents incommunicado. Is that correct?
That's right. The other one is in Marion, Illinois.
Mm.
And what I understand from Marty this week, they're trying to stuff people into the one in Indiana so that they have the leverage to ask for a third one to be opened.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. Talk a little bit about some of the conditions there at the CMU and what this, how this thing is set up. I mean, this is, you know, we all talk about solitary confinement and how that can be used to break somebody mentally, just to isolate them. But this is solitary confinement really on steroids, keeping people for the entire term so they can't communicate to anybody, essentially, right?
Yeah, I mean, this place is beyond the pale. Now, communications are supposed to be monitored at any Bureau of Prisons facility. So to call this a communications management unit doesn't really start to begin what's different about this place. Mm-hmm. Not only are all communications monitored, but they read privileged mail between attorneys and clients.
Wow.
They block mail from getting to the courts. I heard Schaefer say once, what's the difference between a prisoner and a hostage? And it's the ability to reach the courts.
Mm-hmm.
This is very scary. The unit, there's a Bureau of Prisons lawyer named Catherine Seerveld, and she's the one who's leading these charges. Who's leading these policies. She actually, you know, these policies are so detrimental that Marty told me that somebody there tried to swallow razor blades recently.
Wow. Yeah, of course, it's going to break people mentally. That's what it's designed to do. I mean, you look at what's happening to Julian Assange. It's the same type of thing. It's what we do to our political prisoners here in the West, and that's why Putin called it out. He says, oh, you're criticizing me for what we're doing to Navalny? Well, don't blame the mirror when you're ugly. And what we're doing is just as ugly and as sinister as the Russian or the Soviet or the Chinese tactics that they do against their political opponents and against political dissidents.
Absolutely. You know, another thing is we have this Prison Rape Elimination Act that's supposed to protect people from their accusers. There's a unit head there named Todd Royer, who has been violating that with acts of voyeurism, you know, checking people out when they're nude. And recently he escalated to sticking his hand into an occupied shower. Inmates there have sent like at least seven or so BP-10s, which are sensitive forms, to regional, and none of them have been acknowledged. They think that Catherine Seerveld is just blocking them from leaving the unit. So these people are facing all of this kind of bad action and retaliation, and they're not being heard. It's actually so frightening. And like you said, this is not, you know, Russia or communism or China. This is America. This is run under Biden and a lot of presidents before him. And I just feel like, you know, what's the point of grandstanding and cancel culture and all of these other things when you have actual humans subjected to torture, to
yes,
terrible conditions? It's
yes,
horrifying.
Yeah, and when we look at this, you know, they said, well, we need to have this CMU, and as you correctly pointed out, all communications are managed in a prison. You know, it's very difficult to interview somebody in a prison. I've tried to do this before. You have like a 5 minute or 15 minutes that they get in one day during a phone call, but you never know exactly when that's going to be. So you've got to kind of stay there, and they monitor everything they say. But as you pointed out, typically they do not intercept or block any kind of communications between their lawyers. And that's one of the things that's very different about this, and also blocking and intercepting communications between Marty and you, his wife. But when we look at this, and they say, well, you know, we've got terrorists that are there, but they put Schaefer Cox there. He's a political dissident. And Marty was not a political dissident. Marty was somebody who offended a big corporation, if this is true, his conviction. So just by offending a big political corporation like Harvard, they can put you in a gulag, essentially, something that is as bad as we have seen in the Soviet Union. And that's what we should all be concerned about, especially since we've seen that the narrative that they're spinning this all to after January the 6th is to define everybody that is opposed to the current Biden administration as a potential or actual domestic terrorist. Half of the country is now identified as a domestic terrorist because of your political affiliations. And that's really what Putin was talking about when he said, the mirror shows that you're pretty ugly. That's exactly what the only difference between Putin and Biden is, that the U.S. government and Putin and Biden are trying to lie to you and say, no, 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 that's not us. And that's why we need to talk about what is being done now, because it's not just going to be people who are real political dissidents or people who offended some big corporation that are going to be running it. It's a lot of people are going to be doing this, as you pointed out. They're going to be building a third one of these domestically in the U.S. Absolutely amazing that this is happening. And then covering up when you have somebody who has been accused of voyeurism, of sexual harassment of the prisoners there, and they, because of this interception of communications, they cannot get this information out and get any justice done. That's being intercepted, apparently.
Yeah, and also who they send there and how they make that determination is so arbitrary. So we have these units, okay. What about top-tier terrorists? What about people that are actually making efforts to hurt America? Maybe there are some people that should have communications monitored, but what about other people that aren't? You know, they started putting people in there. They call them balancers. The unit is mostly Muslim. They were sued by the Center for Constitutional Rights. And they said, fine, we can't have the unit that's mostly Muslim. So let's bring some other people in there, too. And then you get people like Marty. I mean, Marty's a senior systems engineer working for Fortune 500 companies. We just got married. We have a great life in Massachusetts. And 1 year after marriage, he's arrested, and then within a few years, he's sent to a CMU where it's been sometimes months that I haven't heard from him without any kind of explanation when it stops and when it starts again.
I'm so sorry that has happened to you. I know this is very, and that's the thing, as difficult as it is for Marty, and it's very difficult under these circumstances. The physical, psychological abuse that is happening in these prisons, the isolation that is happening there, but it's also the isolation that is happening to you, Dana. And folks, if you want to help with them, and we'll talk about what has happened this week, the basis for appeals, and how that looks right now. But if you would like to help Dana and Marty, there is freemartyg.com where you can get information. Free Marty, that's M-A-R-T-Y, freemartyg.com. And also there is a Facebook and Twitter, Free Marty G. And you wrote me that GoFundMe disabled your fundraisers and your account after you created a fundraiser for Donald Reynolds Jr. with no explanation. Who was Donald Reynolds Jr.?
Donald Reynolds Jr. is someone who's serving life plus 75 in the CMU. He was the straw man that the government used for the Fast and the Furious operation. He had permits from the federal government to own guns, and they neglected to share that and other facts at his trial, and instead busted him terribly for a crime that he didn't commit. Mm-hmm. And now he's from life plus 75 in the CMU. It's a horrible story.
And we've seen that over and over again. People who are railroaded is like Ross Ulbricht. They said, well, you're not going to be allowed to tell the jury that FBI agents were running the website Silk Road. And we're going to put out information in the press, although they never even indicted him for it, let alone found him guilty. We're going to put out information in the press that said that there was murder for hire. And it's like, well, you're putting these FBI agents who ran this and collected nearly $1 million, you're putting them in jail. We can't tell people that they were in control, that they could have been doing something like this. No, you're going to talk about that. And so we see them doing this in the so-called justice system frequently, keeping vital information away. And, of course, in the case of Ross Ulbricht, he got 3 consecutive life sentences, which means that he can never get paroled unless he gets a pardon. But President Trump thought it was more important to pardon people who are Mossad agents and very successful white-collar criminals who had paid up, I think, rather than to look at the cases of Julian Assange, Marty Gottesfeld, and others. Just another one of these issues of the Trump administration made me disgusted, the kind of pardons that he gave out and the ones that he did not give out. But we have a very corrupt DOJ there. And let's talk a little bit, Marty, about what happened in terms – yes, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to say one thing. There's a great article at the American Conservative called The Knoxville Kingpin Who Wasn't about Donald Reynolds Jr.'s story. Fascinating. Highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. I also was pretty involved in the pardon process. It was such an exciting opportunity to have a president that was going on his own path. And from what I understand from that time, Trump actually was open to doing more pardons, but the counsel's office, specifically Pat Cipollone, or Cipollone, I might be pronouncing it wrong, was blocking and sabotaging a lot of the pardons, either by slow walking them so they just didn't get to him in time, or otherwise convincing him.
Yeah. He was heavily controlled, wasn't he? Let's talk a little bit about what happened in the oral arguments this last week and the three different areas of the appeal that they're pursuing. Because I think when we talk about these different areas, it kind of gives people a glimpse into the railroading process of the Department of Justice. Go ahead and lay out some of what the basis of the appeal was for. The first one was about a Speedy Trial Act, right?
Yeah, there was a Speedy Trial Act. Marty's attorney, Mike Pabian, argued that under the Speedy Trial Act, the government has 30 days to indict after an arrest. But in this case, 246 days passed. So we say that anything above the 30 days was improperly excluded from that time. And so that's an approximately 3-month period that Marty was awaiting a decision about his bail motion.
Wow. So he's supposed to get a trial within 1 month. Instead, they went over 8 months. And it doesn't matter if they violate all the letter of the law, right? Just keep going with it. So that's the first thing. That ought to be cut and dry right there. They play games in terms of when they start the clock. Is that correct?
Yeah. In this case, his magistrate judge is married to a doctor who's affiliated with Harvard University.
Oh, yeah.
She's actually recused herself. Her name is Marianne Bowler. She's recused herself from other Harvard-related cases, and I believe her husband was affected by the DDoS.
She's got a conflict of interest as well. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Talk about the other part of it. Instead of a public trial, what did they give him?
Right. So the Sixth Amendment says that you have a right to a public trial. It's supposed to promote, to ensure fairness and limit the abuse of power. But the district court judge Nathaniel Gorton closed the courtroom on 5 occasions. It was, if you're going to close the courtroom, you at least have to give a reason, and he didn't do that either. So he was taking those things away from Marty.
Mm-hmm. And then the third element of this, talk about that, defense of another.
Yeah, I think defense of another is definitely the one that resonates the most for me. Marty should have had the right to tell Justina's story and what happened. It's up to the jury whether they accept it or not, but they should at least get the chance to hear it. We're not saying what would have happened, but they should at least get the right. Marty shouldn't be prevented from at least putting up a defense that would best serve him.
Yeah. Yeah. In other words, he should be able to make the case that he acted in defense of Justina Peltier, and to tell people what was going on with the medical kidnapping, and they exclude all of that in the same way that we saw with the Bundy trial of many of these individuals. They said, no, you're not going to be allowed to ask people if they were afraid of the BLM or to talk about what the BLM was doing. That's off the record. You can't talk about that. And they kept that out of the trials until you had a BLM whistleblower who exposed that. But to say that, you were afraid of these guys out here, but you can't ask them if they were also afraid of the FBI. Not the FBI, but the BLM. And that's the way they control these trials, by narrowly restricting what is allowed to say. And he should have been allowed to make that case that he was trying to defend somebody else. As you pointed out, they may not have thought that that was sufficient, but he should have been allowed to speak in his defense.
Yeah, it was well documented in the public record that they were using unlawful force against Justina and that her life was at stake. To not include that in this story is highly prejudicial.
Yes.
It's this and a lot of stories. I'm sure I don't need to tell you, but going through this has been such an eye-opening experience about, growing up watching Law and Order and Homeland and all favorite shows, to actually experiencing the criminal justice system up close is a totally different animal.
Yes.
They're not motivated by what's right, by justice, by helping society. It's actually just a career move, the more convictions that they can get. I hope that if I was ever in a position of being a prosecutor, that I would step down rather than just sacrifice my integrity to put people in jail that don't deserve it, especially because there's such a disconnect between what the courtroom is like and what happens afterwards, I think that if people knew what the punishment would be like, I can't imagine that they would feel that way. But
There's so much that is broken about our system. Where is the case right now then? Because you had an appeal hearing or a process that came out on Tuesday. Can you give people an update as to where the case is now?
Yes. One second. So we had oral arguments last Tuesday, and now we wait for the judge's decision. Mm-hmm. That has any kind of timeline. It could be within a few days, it could be within a year, whatever they want.
Wow.
So we're waiting on that.
And so this is in the appeal process, right? And where are you in the appeal process? Is this a lower appellate court so that if it doesn't go your way, you can take it up to, you can appeal that decision higher up?
If we lose the appeal level, it would, the next step would be SCOTUS.
The next step would be what?
SCOTUS, the Supreme Court.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So you're just one level before the Supreme Court. And of course, it's difficult to get the Supreme Court to hear cases.
Yeah.
And again, I want to tell people what they can do to help you. This has been a tremendous ordeal for both of you, and I feel so sorry for you as to what has happened. I wish there was more that I could do. But if you want to go to freemartyg.com, or you can look on Facebook and Twitter at freemartyg, and there are ways that you can help Dana and Marty. And, of course, they also desperately need your prayers. And we need to change this, folks, because this is just this is a pattern. It's not just one isolated case. This is being done to a lot of people, and they're about to expand this to a lot more people. They're going to try to rope in a lot more people that are going to be their political enemies or enemies of these massive corporations. And so we've got to understand what this is about. And we need to push back on this. So is there anything that people can do in terms of getting others, other than just a presidential pardon, contacting others and congressmen or something like that about this CMU that is rolling out to everybody and trying to roll this thing back? I mean, if they could shut that thing down, at least it'd be a better situation for the prisoners who are there.
Yeah. Every so often we start initiatives, such as when the pardons came up and things like that. So if you can join us on Free Marty G on Facebook and Twitter, we'll usually post updates now, updates as they come out.
Good, good. All right. So go there and find out what is happening. We need to have some serious reform of our justice system and of our penal system. We need to understand how these people are using this as personal weapons, using this to advance their careers, and the injustice that is there. God hates injustice. He will listen to your prayers for Dana. Thank you. Thank you, Dana. Appreciate it. We'll be right back.
The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.
right. I was going to talk about the Supreme Court decisions, but I just don't have the stomach right now to talk about our corrupt justice system. I'll talk about that on the radio show. Let's skip over to social justice. And I want you to understand what this is truly about. And as a good introduction to this, I think, and as we see what has happened in the Southern Baptist Convention this last week, I want to play for you what Vadi Bakum had to say about it. Vadi Bakum is a black pastor. I'm not sure if he's a Baptist or not, but he took on the issue. He's written a book. I should try to get him on. I'd like to get him on, called Fault Lines this year. And he was talking about the division that is happening throughout society, but also especially in the church. But what he's saying here in this is predominantly not just directed to Christians. He's trying to get Christians to understand what this truly is. And there's a lot of Christians who do not understand what this is. A lot of big-name pastors, and you'll see in this clip that I got from a YouTube channel called Reformed Wiki, they juxtapose some of his comments about social justice with things that were said by very well-known pastors like John Piper and this guy that we were going to talk to, Al Waddell, yesterday about, David Platt, the guy that Trump went to a few years ago to have him pray for him and then apologize for praying for Trump, that kind of pastor. And so let me just play a little bit of these clips here. The first one is an introduction to the idea of social justice, and then we'll talk about the actual definition of it. And he's not creating a straw man argument. He goes and he reads what the academics say about social justice. But first, the introduction from Vadi Bakum and Reformed Wiki.
Keep on using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means.
Social justice. I wrote down a list of what do you even mean by social justice? So I'll give you a list that I wrote down of what came to my mind by social justice, and then tell me if that's what you think it is, and then we can tackle what's going on out there. I wrote abortion, racial prejudice, human trafficking, health care issues, immigration reform, so-called same-sex marriage, environmentalism. That's my list. Is that what you think of when you think social justice, or am I on a different wavelength?
No, I think you're right. I think there are some things on there that I don't know that the church would see abortion as a social justice issue. I think it is a social justice issue.
Because they're killing people that shouldn't be killed.
Yes.
Oh. So he thinks that abortion is a social justice issue. No. Just drop the social. It's about justice. It's about murder, or it isn't about murder. I think it is about murder. That's the issue. Why would you, as a pastor, why would you, as a Christian, start to try to use these terms social justice? Do you really understand what that means? Why wouldn't you focus on justice? And this is how Vadi Bakum defines social justice. He says, you don't know what this means? Well, here's what it means.
What does social justice mean? Kevin DeYoung wrote, social justice is a nebulous term, unassailable to some, and arousing suspicion in others. And I understand what he means by that in terms of the way we use the term in you know, common parlance. However, as I've said before, the concept of social justice is very clear and completely and utterly unambiguous. We know exactly what it means. Oxford Dictionary of the English Language. Social justice, it's a noun, chiefly politics and philosophy. Justice at the level of a society or state as regards the possession of wealth, commodities, opportunities, and privileges. And it says, see, distributive justice. Again, this is not me. This is the Oxford Dictionary of the English Language, and it says social justice is distributive justice. It's distributive justice. And specifically in politics and philosophy, it's justice at the level of a society or a state as regards possession of wealth, commodities, opportunities, and privileges. That's what social justice means. That's not what I say social justice means. That's what the Oxford Dictionary of the English language says social justice means. I'm not building a straw man. There's a lot of academic literature that lays out and defines social justice. William Young, academic social science and social justice. He writes, while often an amorphous term, social justice has evolved to generally mean state redistribution of advantages and resources to disadvantaged groups to satisfy their rights and social and economic equality. Social justice is state redistribution. That's what social justice means. State redistribution. It is not a heart issue. From a biblical perspective, justice is a heart issue and a law of God issue. Amen? It is a heart issue and a law of God issue. If the law of God says this and you do that, it is unjust. If the law of God says this and your heart goes toward that, it is unjust. Social justice, by definition, is not a heart issue, it's a state issue. And it's about state redistribution and redistribution, again, advantages and resources to disadvantaged groups. Social justice is not about individuals, it's about groups. It's another very important distinction. It's not about individuals, it's about groups and outcomes for groups. So, teaching for diversity and social justice. An analysis of how power, privilege, and oppression impact our experience of our social identities. Let me just run back over that sentence. And again, this is academia. So, social justice is an analysis of how power, privilege, and oppression impact our experience of our social identities. Not the reality of our social identities, but the experience of our social identities. So again, an analysis of how power, privilege, and oppression impact our experience of our social identities. Full and equal participation of all groups in a society that is mutually shaped to meet their needs. To meet the needs of whom? Groups. Social justice includes a vision of society in which the distribution of resources is equitable. Now, there's a difference between equality and equity. We'll talk about that. And all members of a space, community, or institution, or society are physically and psychologically safe and secure. Again, these are academic sources. Okay? I'm not defining social justice. I'm allowing these sources themselves to define social justice.
Again, as we've seen this last week, Southern Baptists are not immune to this. There's not any political, religious, any institution that is not immune to social justice. This needs to be talked about at all these different levels. And he did an excellent job. Again, Vadi Bakum, that's taken from Reformed Wiki. By the way, he's got like an hour and a half of speech. They condensed it down into the different elements. First one is, what is social justice about? And after that, he talks about equality versus equity, how those are different things as well. But notice what he had to say, spot on. The fact that this is about state redistribution. It's about treating people as just what group are you in. That's what intersectionality is about. It's about, well, you're in this group, this group, this group. I'm just going to teach you, treat you. Your skin color is this and your sex is this. And so we're just going to check different boxes. And then we're going to sort you because we've got certain groups that are favored politically and certain groups that are disfavored politically. We're not going to treat you as an individual. We're going to treat you as part of the group. And we're seeing this in healthcare, for example. When we look at this, this is nothing other than Marxism. This is political. It is economic. But they're putting it through the churches by trying to emphasize the justice aspect of this. It's not about that. It's about it's a political tool. It's an economic tool. As a matter of fact, if you go back 3 years ago, fee.org, Foundation for Economic Education, went back to the, I think it was the 1970s. It was an interview of Hayek, the Nobel Prize-winning economist. He was being interviewed by William F. Buckley on social justice. This is nothing new. This has been around 50, 60 years. Why? Because it's even older than that. It's Marxism. And as we were talking about it, the economist, you just heard a pastor talking about that, Vadi Bakum, the economist, F.A. Hayek said that if social justice meant the same thing as justice, the word social would be superfluous. So it means something different. He says everybody talks about social justice, but if you ask people exactly what they mean by social justice, what they accept as justice, nobody knows at the time. And this is back in the 70s. Still, most people don't know. You saw a very famous pastor, David Platt and John Piper. They don't know what it is. Is it abortion? Well, yeah, because I think abortion is unjust, so that must be so. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's about redistributing wealth and income, disappearing the individual, elevating the group, subsuming the individual into the group, and that's what's happening with this whole idea of herd immunity, hive immunity, whatever. You've been subsumed into the hive. It takes a village to raise a child, right? As Hillary Clinton said. This is all about elevating the collective. Why? Because people like Hillary Clinton are empowered when they create a collective. They're empowered when they set one group against another. So Hayek said, nobody knows what this is. He says, I've been trying for the last 20 years. Again, this is in the 1970s. Asking people, what exactly are your principles? And as they point out in Fee, they said to Aristotle, to Cicero, to the founding fathers of America, justice applied to individuals. To social justice advocates, however, justice is collective because everything is collective. That's what empowers them, the collective and the divide and conquer. Implicit in social justice doctrine is the idea that improper imbalance in wealth and in privilege must be corrected. But how? Well, Hayek knew. During this interview with Buckley, he explained to a young Jeff Greenfield, the reporter, that social justice demands that you treat people unfairly, unequally, different treatment for different people. Based on what? Based on which group you've put them in. And therein lies the rub for social justice, wrote Fee. The U.S. Constitution forbids the state from denying citizens equal protection of law. So passing legislation that treats people differently is very, well, tricky. Just like censoring people directly is tricky. So what do you do? If you want to censor people, you create corporations to set up a digital public square and you do the censorship through the corporations after you subsidize them for decades. They don't charge anybody. Everything's free. Everybody come in. You build a monopoly for them of that digital public square. And then you let them monetize it and censor it. That's what we've seen. And in the same way, they said, because the government can't treat people unequally, technically, they've been using a softer, gentler version of social justice to do it through private companies, to do it through elite universities. They have their proxies. It is a softer tyranny, right? It is the velvet glove of universities and corporations that they put over the iron fist of censorship and Marxist redistribution. A notable recent case was Harvard. which stands accused of discriminating against prospective students of Asian descent. Asians must receive an SAT score of at least 1,350, which is 250 points higher than the threshold that they set for Native Americans, Black, and Hispanic high school graduates in order to get a letter for recruitment. So social justice demands treating people unequally. Social justice demands there is no justice for the individual. It deals in groups. It divides people by groups. We have more to say about this, but no more time. So we're going to stop it at this point, and we'll have more to say about that next week. I'll just say this. Kudos to Vadi Bakum for taking this on. Because when he starts talking about something like this, you're going to have people get their feelings hurt. Well, social justice, I like social justice. And he does talk later in the interview about how people are fooled. They say, well, racism, we don't like racism, so let's get on that racism train. He says, you don't realize the engine that's pulling it. He goes, there's a boxcar for racism. There's another boxcar for income inequality. There's another boxcar for LGBT. And they're all being pulled by the same train. Now, he doesn't say it, but I'll say it. It's taking everybody to the gulag. That's where it's taking everybody, to the communist gulag. And you think, hey, I'm with them on this particular issue. But it's not one issue alone. It's a whole chain of issues. And it's a tactic that's being used by people who seek to control us through government, through these corporations that work with government. And so it's very important. Just as I said, the most important thing that we could have during this lockdown this last year were pastors who stood up to this. And that's why they're focusing on these pastors in Canada, locking them up, taking their church buildings and other things, because they've illustrated that this whole thing is a lie. And we need to have people who support true justice, who support equality, not equity, but equality for individuals, who want people to be treated fairly and justly as individuals. We need pastors to take the lead in that as well. And I'm not saying that we turn our churches into social organizations. That's not the main thing of the church. And as some of these pastors who have been locked up said, I'm not trying to reform anything. I'm just trying to obey God. Well, if you want to obey God, you need to tell people what the issues are here. Because your people are being sold into slavery. They're perishing for a lack of knowledge. It bothers me. To see this. Just like it bothered me to know that January 6th was going to be done by agent provocateurs. Who knew? Who knew, right? It's just so obvious. And we have to do the obvious thing, which is to tell people the truth, no matter what it costs us. And we're going to have some good pastors who are going to do this. This is going to be a time of refinement. And you're going to see some of the fake churches that are all about money, about prosperity, about whatever, having a big building, a big crowd, pleasing the government to get that kind of stuff. Don't offend anybody. Don't offend the government, most of all. But don't say anything that's offensive to anybody. You're going to see them blowing away in the wind. You really are. They may appear to be prospering, but they're going to wither very rapidly. The people who will stand on principle, that's why you need to explain this. You need to protect the innocent. That's it. Thank you for listening.
The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find
at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.